Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Ever get the feeling you're being watched? Soon, you will be. Every time you swipe your credit card, make a flight, make a call, buy a box cutter, someone will be watching. And not the FBI or the CIA, but the U.S. Department of Defense. The DOD says it's just a few years away from revving up a massive data mining project that will sift through mountains of personal and financial information looking for the electronic footprints of terrorists. The Total Information Awareness Project is the brainchild of John Poindexter, now head of the DOD's Information Awareness Office. Their motto, knowledge is power. Terrorists can move freely, hide easily, and strike suddenly. But in today's plugged-in world, even terrorists leave electronic signatures. The key to fighting terrorism is information, says the Information Awareness Office website. And soon, the TIA program will be gathering information about you, about everyone. Civil libertarians are outraged. Are you? Must national security this time come before personal privacy? Can this system work? And what kind of brave new world are we entering here? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Farhad Manju, business and technology reporter for Salon.com. He's author of the recent article, Is Big Brother Our Only Hope Against Bin Laden? Good evening and welcome, Farhad Manju.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. Also with us from Palo Alto, California tonight is Jeffrey Ullman, professor of computer science and an expert in database theory at Stanford University. Good evening and welcome, Professor Ullman.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. Thanks so much for joining us. Farhad Manju, your piece on Salon.com starts off with a kind of, very well-known case study of the kind of instance that the Total Information Awareness Project is supposed to, is hoped to, one day spot, capture. It has to do with Mohammed Atta and the kind of information and activity that he was involved in the days leading up to the September 11th attacks. Give us a quick rundown on that as a case in point.
Well, so on or about August 28th in 2001, Mohammed Atta, who at the time nobody knew really, he was 33 years old. He was an Egyptian flight school student. He went to a Kinko's copy shop in Florida, in Hollywood, Florida, and he got on a computer and he bought, using the internet, he bought a ticket, a flight from Boston to Los Angeles for the morning of September 11th.
All right.
He bought two tickets actually for another flight student also. The next day, someone else, another Arab man, this time a Saudi man who was also training to become a pilot, he went to the same Kinko's, and he used a credit card to buy another ticket on September 11th from Boston to Los Angeles. This was on the United flight. And then the day after that, that same credit card was used to buy another September 11th flight from the East Coast to California. And on around the same time, in the last 5 days of August in 2001, all of the men who eventually attacked the three buildings, they all bought their tickets in those last 5 days. And there were lots of things that they shared in common. I mean, they were, for starters, they were all Arab. And this is something that they had in common, not something that, I'm not saying it's suspicious about them, but this is what they had in common.
A shared trait.
They also six of them used the same home phone number. A few used the same credit cards. Some used the same frequent flyer numbers. So they had a lot in common.
All right, let's hold it right there because we've got the picture. We all know what it led to.
Yeah.
I guess the idea is what's motivating the Total Information Awareness Project is encapsulated right there in this case study. Jeffrey Ullman, you know databases inside and out. Hindsight is 20/20. We can pick this needle out of the haystack after the World Trade Center is gone, the Pentagon wing is burned out. But can you imagine a system today or in the future that would be able, out of the daily mountain, galaxy of data that pours out of these United States that might one day spot that little constellation of activity and say to some human somewhere, this deserves attention. Let's track down these men.
Well, let's see. First of all, there are really two levels of question that you can ask. One is, somebody gets the idea that people with Al-Qaeda connections may be training in American flight schools or may be planning to get together on a plane. And an analyst, let's say a CIA or FBI analyst, mm-hmm. wants to ask a system a query that says, tell me about all of the coincidences of three or four or more men with suspected Al-Qaeda connections, or perhaps suspected connections to any organization who have bought tickets on the same flight or have enrolled in flight schools at approximately the same time.
So you're saying if we have a kind of a formula of what we're looking for,
yeah.
it can be applied even to that vast quantity of data, or
well,
could be one
if,
day?
Now, assuming we could gather the data, and this is, you know, this is a big assuming. One of the things which may not be obvious, people sort of assume that it's just easy to integrate information.
It all sounds overwhelming to me. These are all different databases. They're all private companies. They're all kept
right.
in different
okay.
places.
So you have, I mean, you have to get the authorization, first of all, to say mm-hmm. all universities will download their information. All banks will download their information.
Mm-hmm.
All credit card companies, hotels, everybody has got to be willing to download their information. But there's a technical problem that says, of how do you efficiently connect the information from one source to another? Everybody has different ways of representing the data. Trivial, example. You want to someone may be their height may be stored in inches and feet in
mm-hmm.
one database and in centimeters in another database. This is just a very trivial example.
And there you've got a disconnect. So you've got technological challenges, and we're going to
right.
dig into those in this hour. But Farhad Manju, update us on where exactly this stands. This is now underway. Who's doing the research? What's the timetable? What's the goal? When will total information awareness be in gear?
This is right now just a research program. It's a research program under the Defense Department, and the Defense Department has, many research projects.
Mm-hmm.
This one, has some funding. It's not clear how much exactly. There's some sort of debate about that. And it's led by John Poindexter,
mm-hmm.
who was Ronald Reagan's national security advisor and who was embroiled in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Convicted and then acquitted on appeal of
right.
lying to Congress about that scandal.
Right. Right. That fact alone has a lot of people upset about this system.
But DARPA, the group that's doing the research, has pulled off some pretty amazing things before. That's where the Internet originated. So they are not beyond huge ambitions and realizing them.
Right. I mean, and if you ask them, I mean, they're not saying much about it, but they're saying it's a research project and they're trying to work on I think the quote is revolutionary technology, things that aren't just merely a step above what we have now, but things that are sort of completely new.
And applying those to all Americans. The whole point here is that they have to suck up essentially every little bit of data that's out there anywhere in order for this system to work. Is that not right, Farhad?
Right. I think that's what, and Jeffrey Altman can speak to this too, I think that's what sort of distinguishes this idea from other surveillance programs. I mean, you're not focusing on a few people. You're looking at everything, and you're trying to spot in among all of that data, you're trying to spot some patterns. You're not just looking at a few people and saying, because essentially you have no idea who to look at. I think.
So you look at everyone and see whose activity fit the preconceived patterns that you have in mind. We're going to talk about how that might work, but Jeffrey Ullman, I was struck by a comment of yours. This is actually in Farhad Manjoo's Salon.com piece. You say, frankly, I don't see any other way for us to survive as a civilization. Now, you know computer science. You know databases. You, like the rest of us, have seen the terror threat. Is that really your view, that our survival as civilization hangs on this kind of massive data collection, analysis, interpretation?
Well, yes, and not an expert opinion in the sense that I know I don't claim to be an expert on politics, but it is certainly my it's a feeling that I had actually many years ago after the bombings in Africa. What you have, I think it's well known that there's asymmetric warfare going on.
Mm-hmm.
The kinds of deterrents that used to work in the Cold War just don't work anymore.
You can't just scare away another nation because it's individuals with potentially lethal weapons or small lethal weapons.
You're right, and another thing that has happened perhaps slowly over the years is that the ability of one or a few people to cause havoc has gone way up.
So far up that you fear that in multiple instances it could be a threat to civilization itself.
Right. I think the analogy is, 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, maybe more, it was decided that the only way for civilizations to exist in cities, which was sort of the modern invention, was to build walls to keep out the bandits and the marauders.
Mm-hmm. And so walls became the big technology.
The walls became the technology, and I'm sure they didn't get it right the first time, and there are probably people who said, this will inhibit the freedom of the city dwellers. We can't go walk out in the fields at night, and maybe that's even true. But it was just sort of agreed upon that this is the only way to maintain a civilization against the threats that are out there, and as a layman, I feel that this is exactly what has happened today.
There's a major shift in gears, and you don't sound like a man willing to give up that privacy easily. I want to take a quick call here. Our friend Bill Beeman is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Good evening, Bill. Welcome. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm glad to hear that you're doing this program. I had I wanted to fill you in. I had the privilege of being at a session that was sponsored by DARPA last spring, where they did a demonstration of this information network, and had a large number of individuals and advisors that had aided DARPA in setting it up. One of the things that's interesting and curious is that a great deal of the technology and especially the computer tracking that went into the system was the result of advice from the gaming industry in Las Vegas.
Where you're never a stranger, where you're always tracked.
And that's right, where you're always tracked. And the folks in Las Vegas really know what's going on. They have visual tracking. You walk into that to one of those casinos, and they can take a picture of your face and find out exactly who you are, whether you have on a wig or a mustache. We saw a very impressive demonstration about this, and the cross-checking with airlines, hotels, and so forth was amazing.
So Bill Beeman, you've seen a demonstration. You're a smart guy. Were you impressed? Does it look like we could take the Las Vegas-style tracking and apply it to the nation?
Oh, they're absolutely ready to do it. Oh, there's no question. It is ready to go. All we have to do is get the computers cranking, and every piece of credit card information, every hotel registration, every airline booking is ready to go. And be filtered right through the system.
So, Bill, do you feel safer knowing that, or not safer?
Not particularly. John Poindexter himself admitted that this could be used for very nefarious purposes. One has to find an answer to the people who would say that this could be very badly misused. The age of Big Brother is upon us.
Bill, you've got our full attention. Thanks for calling.
Well, let me say one more thing, John. The answer to that is trust us.
Yeah, that's a big request. Bill, we've got to go to a break. Thanks for calling. Bill Beeman is a professor of anthropology at Brown University. We're talking tonight with Jeffrey Ullman and Farhad Manjoo about total information awareness. The project, the research, is underway. It's a Defense Department campaign to know everything about you and everybody else in the interest of counterterrorism. How much privacy are you willing to give up to fight terrorism? Are you willing to give up all your privacy? Is making Big Brother a reality our only hope for national security? Or is this something we've got to fight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about total information awareness, the Defense Department campaign to know everything about you and everybody else in the interest of counterterrorism. And the question is making Big Brother a reality now our only hope for national security? Or is this an impossible dream that won't stop terrorism but will open all of our lives to minute government scrutiny? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Farhad Manjoo. He's joining us from San Francisco. He's business and technology reporter for Salon.com and author of the recent article, Is Big Brother Our Only Hope Against Bin Laden? And Jeffrey Ullman, professor at Stanford University in Palo Alto and author of Database Systems, the Complete Book. Jeffrey Ullman, you started out by saying that what will be required is to put in information about what people are looking for. This is only as good as the kind of, flags that are placed or formula that are input for suspicious activity, suspicious coalescing of activity. But yet we were completely surprised by 9/11. Is it possible to preconceive all the potential or enough of the potential terrorist threats to the United States and superimpose them on all this data so that this is a worthwhile exercise? Or do we do all this and then we're surprised anyway?
First of all, two answers. First of all, what I said was that the first thing you want to do is build a system that lets analysts ask sophisticated queries.
Mm-hmm.
That still relies on them having enough imagination or enough intelligence, in the obvious sense, to know, you know, sort of what might be happening. But there is another level at which the system could conceivably function. And look, I don't want to be go on record as sort of advocating the sort of AI-ish, very far out kinds of systems.
Artificial intelligence, but I'm not following exactly what you mean by that here.
No,
you want the computer to imagine the potential threat configurations?
That's some of the further out AI community would say that, well, you just, you know, the computer will just think like a human being and, mm-hmm. and just know, but have access to all this information and just come up with the threats and the coincidences itself. And I think that's actually very much harder than it looks. It's where we need to go. And I think that there is some data mining technology that has been developed recently that, you know, that suggests we can get orders of magnitude improvement in our ability to do the kind of search that I think Mr. Manjoo was suggesting. where the system is looking for coincidences with very little specificity as to what the coincidence is.
Farhad Manjoo, what legal context does this exist in? Does the government need new legislation to press ahead with this? Can they just do it? Can they order all these private firms to submit the data? What protection do individual Americans have against this being misused, if any?
A couple of things. First of all, I mean, there was some authorization for this in the Homeland Security bill, but it wasn't clear exactly the bill allowed.
So kind of broad language authorizing,
right.
Well, you interpret
right.
yourself.
The Defense Department, if you ask them about this, they say that they completely sort of dismiss the legal part of it, and they say this is just a technology, this is just a research project, and we're not using it yet, so we don't need to worry about that yet. When people start using it, then we can worry about that. But it's clear that there's going to be some sort of legislation needed about this. There have to be rules around this stuff, and virtually everyone who's asking, who says that it we need to have this system also says that we need to have rules around this system. And Jeffrey Ullman says that too. And from talking to people about this, I don't think they're going to push really far ahead with using the system without such rules.
But what kind of legal structure is even imagined that would allow this to be exercised on a massive scale without intruding? I mean, our lives will all be in some considerable degree transparent to the government if they choose to focus on them once this is operational.
Right. That's true. They said a couple things. First, they say that the private data will somehow be kept private, although it's not clear how they're going to do that. Reporters have also asked them about whether the government would need search warrants to get this information in there. And they have, the Defense Department suggested that they would need search warrants, which is odd because it seems that it would be hard to get search warrants.
But you'd have to put in the whole national phone book plus every visitor.
Right. So that's not clear either. But there could be some rules. There could be a rule that says if you misuse this information, it's a crime. I mean, that seems a simple enough rule. And if government, you know, analysts or something like that use the information for purposes other than terrorism investigations, that could be, a criminal offense.
Well, it opens a glimpse of a whole new era. We can only hope that it would have a sophisticated legal structure around it if it should happen at all. Farhad Manjoo, Jeffrey Ullman, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Lee Tien. He's joining us from San Francisco. He's a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Good evening and welcome, Lee Tien.
Hey, Tom.
Hi. Thanks so much for joining us. Your group has been an outspoken critic of this entire project. Why?
Well, I think I've only been listening the last 5 minutes, but I think you laid it out already. We are talking about a program that's vision is to basically do data surveillance of everyone in the United States without any particularized suspicion about them. It will mean collecting vast amounts of data and scrutinizing it all without any particular reason to believe that any particular person you're looking at has actually done anything wrong. And we think that that's counter to the principles of a free and democratic society.
Lee Tien, our guest Jeffrey Ullman from Stanford, says that his concern is that without something like this, there is no other way to effectively guard against individual terrorists, potentially even with weapons of mass destruction, that civilization itself may be on the line here. We may have to accept a new kind of security system that feels very uncomfortable within our old assumptions of privacy and even personal dignity. What's your response?
Well, I mean, I think there's sort of two different responses to that. First of all, we do face a serious threat from the terrorists, but we have no particular guarantee that this kind of system can or will work. And as you said earlier, what we are being asked to do is to sacrifice privacy now for an extremely speculative payoff later. And given, think in terms of what economists call present discounted value, that's not really a very good bargain. Second, it's not clear that given the data, especially the quality or lack of quality of the data we have out there, that you're not going to be getting massive numbers of false positives and false negatives.
False positives meaning, Lee Tien?
Well, in false positives and false negatives simply meaning either you're wrongly suspecting innocent people or you're ignoring people who are actually targets of suspicion.
So the margins of error might be so large on either side that people will be either missed or effectively harassed without reason.
People will be missed. People will be harassed. It's very difficult to know which is which at the time. I just can't imagine this kind of happening without any sort of a massive learning curve that's going to create all sorts of problems for real individuals who are going to be stigmatized or lose their jobs or all sorts of adverse consequences from the errors that are likely to occur. So I'm not sure what can be done about that.
Farhad Manjoo, what have you heard about that? If this turned into the equivalent of erroneous bad credit reports landing on lots more Americans for all kinds of things, people could be walking around with kind of database black marks on them and never know that. What's the scale of the risk there? How might that be avoided?
Well, I mean, it's true. We see in our lives every day that computers go wrong, and sometimes they go wrong spectacularly. So people will be mistakenly fingered, I think, and I think a lot of people might be.
You write that even if the system were 99.9% right, something like 250,000 Americans a year might be, I don't know, hauled up by security agents on suspicion produced by computer surveillance.
Right. I mean, that's just a function of how many people it's monitoring. If it's monitoring a lot of people, even if it's just a little bit wrong, it's going to, get a lot of people in trouble. What they're going to do with those false positives, I mean, how they're going to further investigate them, all of that is not clear. And they haven't said anything about it. I mean, that's part of the whole reason that some people are suspicious about this is because it's so secret. I mean, they haven't said how they're going to do anything about this. And it's not even clear that there's going to be some large public debate about what happens with all of this stuff.
That it simply may slide into effect and be underway.
I mean, it could happen. Lee Tien to me told, worried about, that there might be some terrorist attack, and then they might say, we have to put this into place now.
And that's that, and it's done. Lee Tien, do you fear that another attack or two or three would break down political resistance, national resistance to this, and it will just become a fact of life for Americans?
Well, that is one of my major concerns. I mean, now, of course, we have to, I think we should be very clear that what they're talking about, they admit they have not yet done. They're not ready to go with this. There's a lot of work they plan to have to do. But my concern is that as they move along, producing pilot projects for different agencies, reaching, getting somewhere toward their goals, and then there is an attack, and then the political situation just becomes like, okay, we're going to have to try this.
We're afraid. We're desperate. Bring it on.
Yeah, and then we're stuck. The same way that Congress passed the Patriot Act immediately mm-hmm. after September 11th without giving it hardly any scrutiny whatsoever. And that's why, even though TIA is a ways off, I think, in time, that's why we and other, EFF and other civil liberties groups have been mm-hmm. saying, let's look at this really hard right now because we may not get another chance.
Lee Tien, Jeffrey Ullman, Farhad Manjoo, please stand by. We have a mountain of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Jack's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you tonight?
Fine, thanks.
I've been a private investigator for about 20 years,
okay.
And a couple points I'd like to make
mm-hmm.
is that I've been watching the growing power and sophistication of commercially available databases for about 10 years, and also a growing a black market in all this kind of information, which is growing in sophistication. I'm very sympathetic to the civil libertarian point of view, but I would point out that the cow left the barn about 10 years ago, and it really is way too late to try and control this information.
You're saying it's all out there in an ad hoc way already.
Absolutely, it's all out there.
But yet, Jack, it's not. I guess it's not being analyzed and run through the kind of programs that would pull out the patterns of terrorist activity that we're talking about tonight. I mean, we didn't foresee 9/11.
No, but that goes to another point I'd like to make. If this is even this is developed to a very sophisticated level,
mm-hmm.
if it's kept closely held by the government, it's really a Maginot line that terrorists with any smarts can go right through. I mean, the best thing to do with this information, if you're going to create the database at all,
mm-hmm.
is to make it as public as possible, as fast as possible.
Why?
Well, then it would have the effect of like a bright light in a parking lot. We would live in a more transparent society, but the information wouldn't be centrally controlled from a position of power.
Ooh, this is getting more conceptually challenging at every turn. Jack, let me put that to Jeffrey Ullman. First of all, Jeffrey, Jack says, look, there are a lot of databases out there already. He's a private investigator. He says we're all naked already. But aren't we talking about a kind of difference in scale here?
Well, we are, actually. I believe he's right. I think, for example, someone mentioned the credit. You can get a black mark on your credit.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because the credit database is available to essentially anyone.
Any retailer, certainly.
If anyone falsely reports my having, let's say, welched on a debt,
mm-hmm.
Anybody knows that. The kind of system that I believe is being contemplated is something that is where the data and especially the inferences are very, very closely held. And it doesn't bother me if a computer thinks incorrectly, and this is one of these false positives, let's
mm-hmm.
say, it thinks incorrectly that I went out last night and bought drugs and had a date with my mistress.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't bother you. You're a pretty open guy.
No. As long as the computer, I mean, that doesn't bother me any more than mm-hmm. the fact that my lamp sees me naked.
Okay.
Okay.
Your Labrador Retriever, your dog.
Right. It's unfortunately I don't have a dog, but that's
okay. We got the point. It's kind of a mindless observer at one level.
Yeah. Now it's only when, as must be the case, when these positives come back, and whether they're false positives or true positives, we don't know. But they have to be looked at by a real person, and I think that the only solution is that this person has to have an ethic that says, you know, not only will they not report or use what they learn, assuming that it's investigated and found that this is not a case of terrorism, it's
mm-hmm.
not a threat against the country or the world,
mm-hmm.
That they will keep mum about it and not use it for their own purposes, or just blackmailing me.
What's your level of confidence in that, Jeffrey Elbin?
I don't know how we're going to get to that point, frankly, but it's not unprecedented. I mean, you know, for example, the military could stage a coup, but they don't. And that's because our mores were very early on in the history of this country established that said the military simply does not do that.
We don't do that. Lee Tien, I know we've just got you for another minute. How confident are you that the government will keep this information and use it, if it goes ahead, only to track terror and not be tempted to dip in for all kinds of other reasons or curiosities, licit or illicit?
I have no confidence in that at all. I mean, when I talk to people about this, my rhetorical question is, what do you think J. Edgar Hoover would do with this kind of ability to, you know, do data surveillance? I mean, people in power do things with this data that is not within the rules. And so our feeling is that if you don't have very strong accountability, both technical and legal, as well as ethical, the way that Professor Ullman said, this system is far, far too dangerous to ever be implemented.
Data valence, we're getting challenged with new words, new ideas all around here tonight. Lee Tien, in just a few seconds we have left, is there something going on to counter this in the courts? Is it too early even to do that? Is there opposition that's organized?
Well, it's certainly too early to counter it in the courts because it hasn't gone into play, but there is certainly some level of political opposition to it. When it was announced by, or given wide publicity by William Safire, there was a brief, although fairly loud, cry of opposition. Currently, EFF is running a couple of letter-writing campaigns.
This is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, your group.
That's right. We're asking our members and others to write to Senators Hatch, Senator Stevens, who will be chairing probably the Senate Judiciary and Appropriations Committee, to follow up on a request by Senator Feinstein, who formerly was chair of the Terrorism and Technology Subcommittee.
To look into it. Lee Tien, we've got to go to a break, and I'm sorry, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Lee Tien is Senior Staff Attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're talking total information awareness. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Total Information Awareness Project, the Defense Department campaign to know everything about you and everybody else in the interest of counter terrorism. My guests tonight are Farhad Manjoo. He's business and technology reporter for Salon.com. And Jeffrey Ullman, professor of computer science and an expert in database theory at Stanford University. You can join the conversation as well. TIA research is underway. Do you feel that the country has properly signed off on this? And would you surrender your privacy to save civilization as we know it? Are those the only options? Do you trust? We can draft laws that will keep an all-knowing government agents from misusing private information. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Eric is calling. Welcome, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There is a moral dimension to this, I believe. Which,
a moral dimension.
Is occasionally brought up sort of at the beginning of these conversations, but it doesn't last very long. I'm not so sure about what we mean by civilization as we know it. Because I think that the question of what a civil society is basically how a civil society operates is precisely what's at issue here. Jeffrey Ullman said that he was content to be monitored in this fashion and didn't have any problem with that any more than being watched by his lamp.
I think that's not quite what he said, but we'll come back to that. But your point, Eric.
My point is that I do have a problem with that. I have a moral and ethical problem with that. And one way to end civilization is to subject people to the complete indignity of being constantly monitored.
Well, terrorism forces us to think about exactly what we mean by civilization. You're quite right about that. Jeffrey Ullman, step in here. When you say that, and we admit this may have been an off-the-cuff remark, but what are the elements you're
saying? Exactly what I said and exactly what I meant.
And what do you mean by it? So we can put it up against what Eric is thinking of.
Well, I stand behind that remark. Many people, I guess, you know, think of computers as more alive than they are and somehow different from lamps. And the fact that information exists about me, and it exists now, it's just not in this accessible form that the TIA people would like to make it be. I guess it's a personal sense that it just doesn't bother me that information about me is available electronically.
So data exists, light exists.
As long as it doesn't have any consequence on my life.
Well, yes. What's your level of trust that it will be handled by a government with great tools for manipulation without consequence for you or another American?
My level of trust is probably no greater than that of Mr. Tien. I think it's a serious problem, but it's one that we have to solve. And I do have a fair level of trust that there's not going to be a military coup in this country in the next 20 years. I think that 20 years from now there has to be an equal level of trust that the government is not going to take advantage of the existence of this sort of information mining system for its own purposes.
But a coup is a public event that everyone can oppose. This kind of data could be used to pick off, harass, you name it, individuals one by one in a way that would be almost invisible. But Jeffrey Ullman, I want to put the other side of this to you, if you'd be kind enough. Eric raises the issue of what we fear for when we fear for civilization. He says if we don't have the dignity of privacy, then if we don't have the kind of that kind of guarantee, then what are we fighting for? When you fear losing civilization at the hands of terrorists, what is it that you fear losing that this might protect?
That's a good question. I assume that civilization is the most advanced way of life that we have on the planet at any time. I cannot define it, but I think I know it when I see it. And to me, privacy from the snooping of machines is a very, very tiny part of that. I'm not an expert in this.
We understand and we appreciate you're struggling with it, your search with it. Now, let me put it back to you, Eric, our caller. On 9/11, we saw the financial center go down. We saw air traffic stop. We saw national life practically come to a halt. Multiply that times whatever factor you like, and can you imagine some level of loss for which you'd be willing to trade your privacy? We may not have Eric there. Oh, gee. A question posed. The caller gone. I'm sorry for that. Eric, we'll have to catch up with you another time. Jack is calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot. Great show. Just some very quick points, and I'll get off the phone. The first is we have a system like this in place already with the telephone networks in the United States. It's run by the NSA, the National Security Administration, and it scans every single phone call made in the United States. Okay, and it scans
looking for keywords, phrases,
keywords and phrases, and then there's a whole system of checks and balances. If they hear like criminal discussions, they cannot report that to the FBI, and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but if they hear like nuclear weapons, then they take a closer look. It's like a flag, and they don't come and arrest you and take you away and put you in a gulag. They just take a closer look if they hear something that's of concern.
So, Jack, you're saying there's already a precedent that should give us some comfort that this won't be widely misused.
Exactly. And here's my other – I have two other very quick points. My other point is this is an issue of power. Information is power.
Sure, okay? Is. Yes,
now,
it is.
Exactly. And we already have enormous power in this country. What keeps all the other forms of power, for instance, the fact that we're the most powerful military in the world, from turning this into a totalitarian dictatorship? What does that is that we have a system of checks and balances. And the key with this is to, if we work with this new technology, this new way of sharing information, okay, which is just an expansion of the NSA system, okay?
Well, the justice is a large word there, though.
Well, I think that's a fair point, Tom. You're right. It's a big step. But nevertheless, the key is with any kind of power is to build in checks and balances with different branches of government oversight on this, a system of checks and balances, because that's how we manage all other forms
of
power.
Okay, we've got the point. Let me put it to Farhad Manju. We're running out of time, Jack. Thanks for your call. Farhad, can you imagine an effective system of checks and balances emerging in this kind of largely submerged secret world of Department of Defense intelligence around terrorism?
Probably not. But that's probably how that's probably not how they should do it. And Lee Tian earlier was talking about Congress people and senators and people in Congress sort of discussing this, and that's probably the way that they ought to go. So if it's kept secret, it probably you won't see the kind of protections that people like Lee Tian want, and that's why it shouldn't be kept secret.
Jeffrey Ullman, our time is running down, but as a database specialist, take one more pass at this issue of how effective this can be. As you said, it can recognize patterns of behavior down to minute levels if it's pre-informed of those patterns, presumably at some point. But terrorists tend to look for the thing that hasn't been done, to do the unexpected thing. Could a system like this ever be effective against that? And if it can't, is it not, as one caller said, the Maginot Line, just sitting there waiting to be sidestepped?
I think this is an important research area. I don't know how far we could go if the government put the kind of money it put into the Manhattan Project into getting top computer scientists the way they got top physicists in the 40s to really work on this. I think that, this will not be a perfect system. It'll get better if it's, as experience develops.
Will it attract our top computer minds?
I think that if the environment were right, many, not all, would be willing to take a look at this.
It sounds like a kind of holy grail challenge.
By the way, I'm not stumping for my research. This is for younger people. There are lots of bright computer scientists out there, and I think that many of them would step up if the facilities were there, if they had the freedom to do research and not have to write monthly progress reports and so on, and just conduct research the way research needs to be.
At a scientific level, everything else aside, it sounds almost irresistible, especially if it gets put into a Manhattan Project style envelope, but oh, the repercussions. Jeffrey Ullman, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Ullman is professor of computer science at the Stanford University and author of Database Systems, the Complete Book. And Farhad Manjoo, you've been very generous with your time and thoughts. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Farhad Manjoo is business and technology reporter for Salon.com. He's author of the recent article there entitled, Is Big Brother Our Only Hope Against Bin Laden? You can continue this conversation online, onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, creating the next Christmas toy sensation. This is On Point. For much of America, the big challenge of the Christmas shopping season is finding the perfect toy. For Donald Hutchinson, that is his challenge every day. Hutchinson works in inventor relations for Fisher-Price in New York City. It's his job to screen new toys dreamed up by ambitious creators trying to come up with the next big toy, the next Tickle Me Elmo. In this radio diary, Donald Hutchinson talks about the inventors who come to him with their new toys.
The ones that are scarier, funnier, and then sometimes scarier are the people who have one idea that they think is going to make them $1 million, and they'll pitch a concept, and then they won't take no for an answer, and sometimes you get continued follow-up calls, which get stranger and stranger. There was a woman, she sent in a concept that had to do with angels, and, you know, this is your special angel love friend doll or something, and you know, they took it in, they looked at it, and they rejected it. And then she kept coming back and came to the point where she was actually stalking him around the building. And he was slipping out the back when she was coming in the front because she was sending more threatening and more frightening letters to him. You know, how, you know, this was her mission, to God told her to complete this. And so you do get all kinds. I had one where he sends this whole letter about, you know, how kids don't have any real role models, toy companies are out there selling Barbie, and these are unrealistic aspirations for children. So he's developed a doll with realistic aspirations, and when you see this doll, you'll know why. He said he's built a doll that's based on the proportions of his wife, which I just thought was really interesting. When you're looking at a toy concept, you have to understand what makes a marketable toy, what makes for a good TV commercial, or if it's not going to be on TV, the other way you're going to promote it most likely is on the shelf. So it has to have what we call a try me, which means when you walk up to it, you have to have to press a button. It does something for 2 seconds, and that will sell it to the consumer on the shelf. We know kind of how much motors cost and how much voice chips costs, and you can kind of see a toy concept when someone brings it to you and kind of figure out in your head that's going to be a $20 toy, it's going to be a $30 toy. You have to see what's marketable, what's going to be designable, and also what's going to be possible. What makes a feasible toy concept is kind of a combination of all these things. I think you have to be a kid at heart to work at a toy company. I remember when I first started working here, I mean, you could not resist the temptation. You know, every time I'd have a pile of toys on the cart, you'd want to press a button, hear what it does, see it move, see what it does. And I think you can't help it. I mean, there's always someone with a remote control car. I mean, when those scooters were the trend, we had a bunch of them in the office, and people would be zipping around on them just to and from the fax machine. So you find ways to keep that kind of child within happy. It's a difficult, and it's a business, and a lot of people will say to me, oh, what is your job, just like big? And at first I used to say, no, you know, it's like this, and we've got this, and paperwork, and all this stuff. But usually now I just go, yeah, my job's just like big.
A scooter for Jimmy.
A dolly for Sue.
The kind that will even say,
how do you do?
When Christmas Day is here, the most wonderful day of the year.
Donald Hutchinson works in inventor relations for Fisher-Price in New York City. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.